Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodontist. This is the most plagiarized man on the internet, Matthew Raphael Johnson. I've gotten an email. Someone's asking me who wrote the text for the intro of my website. That is not me. I couldn't write about myself in the third person if you paid me. That was someone from the TWP, the Traditionalist Workers Party. And of course, they're the ones who are paying for it. And I thank them for that. Of course, I approved it, but I did not write that. And if you're wondering what website I'm talking about, it is my own. That is Rus Journal, RUSJournal.org. I've been on the web personally since, this must have been 2002. I started the American Journal for Russian and Slavic Studies, which continued until I shifted it to the Voice of Reason Network. Maybe that was in 2011, 12. And then poor Mike Connor disappeared, and everything went with it. There's a few articles on there now. So, but that was a very difficult time in my life. And it was the TWP, Matt Heinbeck, and my parrot, who kind of lit a fire under me and said, get broadcasting again. And so they created a lot of this for me, and I, of course, always thank them for it. But it's the party that wrote that for me, and I approved it, but it's all true, and I accept it all. At the moment, I'm working on first of all, I'm still trying to get my Ukrainian nationalist thought book published. This is probably the thing that I'm most proud of. I'm very happy with it. Of course, the broader argument is that Ukrainian nationalism is quite legitimate, just having nothing to do with what's happened in Ukraine since 2004, where you have an alleged nationalist movement whose first plank is that the Ukraine join the EU. You know, this is laughable. Ukraine couldn't possibly join the EU since it doesn't have a functioning economy. But that's not stopping them. And the second thing, I have a series of essays on different revisionist aspects of the Soviet Union. And I'm not really sure about publishers there. I was negotiating with Arctus, guys who I like very much. But I don't know, if financial problems or something got in the way of that. So we'll see where that goes. I am on Hromada Press, which uses Lulu as a binder and retail platform. And my latest book is on the Middle East. It has to do with the ideological failures of the U.S. In the Middle East, why this occurs, and what are the structures of power that back it up. Now, the last two podcasts, the last week I wasn't very well, as always. The prior two podcasts kind of came from out of nowhere. The first one on Pikeville was, you know, it was a really extraordinary event. I had to break the continuity there for a bit, and I'm glad I did it. And the second one really was almost, it's something that I've been bottling up for a long time, issues that are really bothering me, especially as a true Orthodox church. Struggles. The truth of the matter is that the true Orthodox Church, that is to say, those who reject Constantinople, so the canonical church, those who refuse to break the dogmatic canons in that respect, are so fragmented. You know, had they been unified, it would be a huge organization. The TOC, has, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, if not more, worldwide. You know, it has a huge presence in Greece. It has a huge presence in Russia. And it's been influential in making sure, you know, at the very least, holding the mainline church's feet to the fire on issues. And things seem to be going better. Recently, Georgia has rejected this ridiculous council in Crete. Georgia has also been out of communion with Antioch for a long time because of their ecumenism with the Monophysites. So Georgia is probably the most traditionalist of all of the mainline groups. And also the most nationalist, which, you know, shouldn't be a big surprise. The nationalisms of Eastern Europe, and nationalism in general, especially when you're talking about a single civilization, these aren't contradictory. They have their disagreements like everyone does. I mean, we disagree with ourselves sometimes. We change our minds. You know, we have arguments with ourselves sometimes. That doesn't mean anything. You know, Belarus is a great example. Belarus has a distinctive culture. It has bits of Poland, has bits of Ukraine, has bits of Russia, has bits of Lithuania. But a very strongly Orthodox nation in close union with Moscow. I think that should be the same with Ukraine. There is no canonical reason why Ukraine shouldn't have its own patriarch and its own church. But there's no reason for them to be anti-Russian, except that the Russians have done everything possible to derail and to harm any kind of autocephaly there. And that's led to the disintegration of that church, except for the one large one led by Filaret, who apparently won't die. Who's the cause of all the problems there. He's a former KGB agent that when he wasn't given the job as Patriarch of Moscow, as he'd been promised, went back to Ukraine. He's of Ukrainian background. And condemned Moscow and overnight became a Ukrainian nationalist. And he has a lot of money that comes from nowhere. He has a wife and kids. He doesn't believe in anything. He's as liberal as they come. And he's the face of Ukrainian nationalism in the church. The Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church used to be run by the great Mefodiy. It was a good man who created two Russian catacomb hierarchies, that of Raphael and that of Vyacheslav, which is now run by Alexis in Moscow. They're small, but these are catacomb groups that needed a hierarchy, and the Ukrainian autocephalous gave it to them. There's simply no reason, there's no problem with that, nothing wrong with them. Unfortunately, these groups still accept Constantinople. I spent a lot of time on this show and on my website, my writings, talking about that Constantinople has been out of the church for a long time. Now, I did the thing on the bishops and grace and all that to impress on everybody that bishops aren't everything. If you read a history of the Orthodox Church in the 20th century, all you read about is bishops. It's like there's no people, there's no priests, there's no monks. You know, The church isn't in any way somehow collected in the person of the bishop. Heaven forbid that be the case. And that actually fits into what we're going to do now, which is continue this question of symphony. Some people like to sound smart and say symphonia. Like subordinost, it's an abused word. You know, you don't have a great Orthodox intelligentsia in this country or really anywhere anymore, you know, and there's a handful. But I'm trying to set the record straight. One of the things I need to do in this is to prevent the use of modern terms and our debased modern understanding of these terms to then be read back into Christian history. I said this a million times, I'll say it a million times more. Words like justice or law or constitution or state or crown, any of these things, don't have the same meaning. Family is a great one. Symbol. Don't have the same meanings back then as they do now. The translations are great. They're not the problem. But they've changed so radically as our minds have become so debased. A rotten society is going to take all meaning out of things, and words are included in that. And so, you know, one way you could spot an amateur dealing with these topics is when they use modern terms in our present, you know, 2017 way of thinking to describe, you know, 18th century Russia. That's not what a historian does. A historian tries to understand people the way they understood themselves. What did they think that they were doing? Now, your average Orthodox person knows what symphony is. And you ask them what it is, they'll say it's some kind of cooperation between two entities, the church and the state. Now, what people think when they say those words are often very different. The modern view of it has completely, erased its real meaning, as always. It's not an accident that, Heidegger, one of the ways that he tried to reform philosophical discussions is to go to the original meanings of words. That's one of his favorite things to do. And he finds that, the present use of the word is completely debased. So sometimes I use the church and the crown, because the state is not an issue here. There's a huge difference between the state and the crown. The state is a more or less modern development, a rationalized bureaucracy in Weber's sense, self-interested, it's self-perpetuating, it uses violence, it pretends to have a monopoly of violence in a certain area, and in and of itself has no real reason to rule. In and of itself, it's completely illegitimate, unless it's attached to the crown. The crown is completely different. Very much like a bishop. A bishop does not rule anything in our modern sense of the term. The crown doesn't rule anything either. It's kind of odd to say that you rule and you pass laws when, of course, the ancient idea of law, medieval idea of law, was that it's not something for a legislature to pass. It's something for us to continue to refine and understand. We're talking about natural law here in the broader sense of the term. We're talking about a society, experiencing things, experiencing problems of all kinds. And this forces it to refine and give a broader understanding to its essential identity. Same thing goes for the church. Canons, as I also said before, people talk about the canons as if they're talking about the Pennsylvania Penal Code. That's not what a canon is. Canons are really, they're pedagogic. Canons are a tracing of church history. They tell us what the church has suffered and what's important to it. Most of the canons, most people ignore. It's either being impossible or irrelevant or whatever. There's a canon that says, I had some trouble with this, the canon that says, more than one actually, that priests can't be involved in any kind of public affairs or care, worldly cares. Well, that's nice. I mean, if, our 18th century Russia, 17th century Russian had a large parish, could take care of everything, that would be great. But of course, we don't have that anymore. And of course, what that canon really refers to is either, a priest joining the state apparatus in some kind, in some way. Today, we would say if they're running for office or taking a government job. If I were to run a business. Especially if it was usurious. And that took me away from my priestly duty. So that's what that canon refers to. But, whenever you talk about a canon, these aren't landmines. These aren't, tightropes. These aren't tripwires. These are expressions of the church as to what is important to it. The complex element is our own motivations. Most of it is in the subconscious. We're not even aware of it. You read two pages any psychology textbook, and you'll realize just how complex motivation is. Canons are not laws in the penal sense. They're educational. They're pedagogic. They're very general guidelines. I'm just talking about the disciplinary one. I'm not talking about the dogmatic ones. These are general guidelines as to how the church functions. But what I mean by the church, this has been the problem. I get very upset when the church is reduced to its bishops. And it's becoming more of a problem because now the true Orthodox Church, has got thousands of bishops. The quality can't be great. The quality can't be very high. I know this for a fact. If you become a monk, you're pretty much going to become a bishop. Even in the mainline churches. There's far too many of them. And the true Orthodox Church has hurt itself. My former jurisdiction, I wish them well, of course, but they have about, 30 people and 7 bishops. I don't even know what these guys do. This isn't, bishops are the expression of the body. They're elected by the body. They're sustained by the body. And really, they are an institution rather than a person. They're the expression of the church. St. John Maximovich is very clear here. One of my favorite quotes from him says the following. The church consists of both her earthly and heavenly parts. The Son of God came to earth and became man, that he might lead man to heaven and make him once again a citizen of paradise, returning to him his original condition of sinlessness and wholeness, uniting them, him to himself. Then John of Kronstadt says the following. God has bound the Orthodox faithful to himself by means of one spirit and one church, by one faith in the unity of his law, mysteries, and the hierarchy, the general good of his rational creation. One must hold on his bond throughout holiness of life and submission to one another. End quote. The submission to one another is extraordinary. Today, you refer to rule as being able to tell someone what to do. That's not what it meant. Rules or measures are identical with the idea of justice, with natural law, with the forms. Ruler, you know, we measure things. We see how much they stand up to reality, or that which is unchanging in this chaos that we live in. But what John of Kronstadt is saying, and to a great extent, law, mysteries, hierarchy, and the general good of our people are not really that different from one another. These lines are extremely extremely foggy most of the time. You know, there's an earthly, this empirical side to the church. But that's not what we're talking about when we refer to the church. Church and state, no, we're referring to grace. Grace, light, energy, whatever you want to use. Energy really is not a mysterious word. Grace is grace and light. It's simply God's presence on earth. It's God's presence relative to us. That's all it is. There's nothing extraordinary about it, except that, you know, God does care for his people. Why create anything if he's not going to care for it? But of course, John of Kronstadt also notes that there is only one of these. There is one church and there is one law. But it does have specific local and national expression. But the same thing goes for the state. I think the last time I talked about Symphony, I ended up talking about Justinian, who made this very clear distinction between a civilization and a nation in his The Institutes, Book 1, Section 2-1. There's a broader cosmic whole governed by God. But this natural law is very, very vague. As I've said many times before, you know, there's no nation in the world. We're not the U.S. excluded, of course. It's, you know, this is a perverse era, but in general, there's not a single nation in the world that celebrates adultery or that gives presents to people who are cowards. These things are simply part of being human. No one denies them. But this is always very general. How this manifests itself in the world and what this really refers to is something completely different. The nationalist idea is to stress the local expression. This in no way can ever be out of sync with the truth and the broader law. But the only way that this law can be expressed rationally is by using language. This language refers to everything. The words we use, as well as whether it could be ritual or the icons and the books and our way of life and the example that we're supposed to be. You know, we talk about the lives of the saints as this general concept. All we mean is... all we mean is this set of examples. What is it for a man to actually be saturated with grace? What does he do? The extraordinary things that the saints do derive from the fact that through asceticism, the total cleansing of the human body, they could see more than we can. They could see, their senses are heightened. Prophecy is the same way. Prophecy really isn't that mysterious. Truth is very easy to get to, but you have to put self-interest aside. The prophet removes all extraneous detail and gets straight to the essence of the matter and describes it in very succinct terms that everyone can understand. Natural law doesn't have to be uniformly enforced. There are general axioms that make human life actually human. So the needs of man in general are identical. We all have to eat, we have to drink, we have to not die from exposure. But that's where it ends. How this is manifest is no concern of natural law. Remember, I defined ritual as that set of actions, that repetitive set of actions that attempts to bridge the gap between ideal and the empirical, or the noumenal and the empirical. We have these wonderful ideas we truly agree with, but when we try to manifest them in day-to-day life, they're very easily forgotten. And when we forget them and we go against them, or even, you know, make it foggy, it's very easy to rationalize. Rationalizations are very, very easy. That's extremely dangerous. But Justinian also clearly states that ethnic tradition, which he refers to the law of nations, and linguistic unity, is how natural law is made manifest. Last time I mentioned Alcuin, one of the few people who actually puts the emperor above the church in the sense that the church couldn't function. Remember, he's writing in the age of the Vikings. The state is not secular. The secular power, quote unquote, doesn't exist. The empire, this is a religious institution primarily. Its entire existence is based on God's power. So you think of two entities. The crown, or this manifestation of natural law, on the one hand, and God's presence, grace and light and truth, that we try to manifest every day on the other. That's what we mean by church and state. But in general conversation, you can't go through that each and every time. We have false ideas. We're referring to a crown, and we're referring to God's grace. The most ridiculous thing that I hear is when people say, I can't be a Christian because those people are all hypocrites. Number one, they usually don't know what hypocrite means. Hypocrite doesn't mean inconsistent. Hypocrite means that the person who is spouting this argument doesn't believe it. Like a politician has to be all things to all men. That's hypocrisy. It's not believing it. But you need it, so you use it. Inconsistency is not hypocrisy. We're all inconsistent. It doesn't make sense, because that has nothing to do, either way, it has nothing to do with the truth of the church. The truth of the church isn't harmed whatsoever by the fact that we are very, very far from the apostolic standard. And right now, we've never been farther, and that's not going to change anytime soon. But that doesn't mean the apostolic standard needs to change. The word economia means to build. That's what an economy is, to build up a society. We talk about economy in canon law as kind of this blanket excuse to ignore something. But what it means more precisely is that when a canon gets in the way of the good of the church, it should be ignored. Now, I've said this many times. These aren't absolute, penal statutes that automatically enforce, you know, like a tripwire sets off a bomb. No, that's not what it is. The very fact that they could be ignored in certain cases, it's why they're ignored in certain cases. I mentioned the last time about, a priest, to be a priest, has to be a virgin at the time of his ordination, same for his wife. Remember, the wife shares in the priesthood of her husband. She bakes the communion bread. It's very important. But that's simply impossible today. There'd be no priests if that were the case. So it's ignored because we can't have a situation where there's no priests. So that canon gets in the way of the church. It gets in the way of the building up of the church. That's what economia means. And I think we ended the last time talking about the Roman Empire. The idea of Rome refers to civilization in general. It refers to a civilization governed by natural law. It's not an ethnic group. It's not a nation. It's an empire. It's a civilization. And I'm using these synonymously in this case. It's a federation of nations. Nations have always existed from the beginning of the world, but they haven't always been politicized. An empire is a gathering of nations. There's good reason to join the Roman Empire because it gave a tremendous communications, a stable currency. It gave you big markets. You know, going to a defeated group of people, you go to their elite who have just lost the war. Well, you don't kill them. You don't send them to the mines. You use them. Anyway, we, so again, these aren't really enemies. They were enemies only to the extent that they were in service to a defeated ruling class. So nations aren't harmed at all. I mean, so you can believe in an empire, but understand what it really is. At the same time, remember, empires didn't rule in the sense that we would use the term today. It's constituent nations. The empire was meant to be, you know, dealing with taxes and stable currency, national defense. That was pretty much it. Everything else was taken care of at the lower level. Now, the older definition of politics only referred to what the empire would do. It has nothing to do with concerns of justice. So when a priest gives a sermon condemning usury, he's in no danger of losing his tax-exempt status. Politics refers to the actual running and ruling of the apparatus. Today, though, politics means everything. Well, if everything's politicized, that means everything can be regulated. Anyway, so the general point is we have these two concepts misunderstood always, existing side by side, because they have the same origin, and that's God the Father. Christ was the manifestation of everything that is human, you know, culture, language, economics, everything else, attached to everything that's divine. Not absorbed by it, not dominated by it. The whole point of Chalcedon is that human beings don't cease being free by being members of the church. Chalcedon was a huge threat to the ruling class. It always has been. Remember, there's not a heresy that wasn't enforced ruthlessly by the Roman Empire. It's because all these heresies benefited the state. Both the you know, kind of monophysite idea, where the state seems to be, you know, left alone to do as it pleases because humanity is being absorbed into the divine. Free will is not that important. On the other hand, Arianism, or especially Nestorianism, separates the two entirely. Nestorianism has always been a favorite of the state because the two don't even know each other. The state's kind of left alone in that sense. The iconoclastic emperors were highly centralizing emperors just because the iconoclastic mentality demanded it. Iconoclasm removes all mediation. You know, iconoclasm had nothing to do just with icons. It had to do with all the cultural expressions that we use to talk about God. Icons just being one. It destroys all culture. It removes everything that separates the ruling class from the people. And that was a godsend to the emperors and even the Protestant Reformation, the states that supporting Luther was supported by the ruling class to a great extent because it was their ticket to power. And monastery lands, that was kind of a big thing, but it was their ticket to power. And all the new Protestant states of Germany were tightly centralized, unlike the Catholic ones. This is what nominalism does. This is what the rejection of Chalcedon does. Nations are not, you know, it's people, you know, I'm fighting this battle every single day of my life. And usually what I'm getting is my opponent's made up definition of what nationalism is. They make up something bad in their head, and then they say, this is nationalism, I'm against it. I say, yeah, there's a huge literature on this. Nationalism is not the state. It often has something to do with the state. Generally speaking, the state is usually at war with the nation, although not always. The state is necessary for nations. But this notion of civic nationalism, you read a textbook and it'll say that the French Revolution gave birth to the concept of nationalism. And I want to scream. You know, one of these days I'm going to just find the author and just slap him across the face. I'm so sick of this. How, in any conceivable way, could a individualist, mercantile body that despised everything that French culture was be nationalist? It's the precise opposite of it. It's as absurd as saying that Ayn Rand is an example of socialism. Nationalism isn't the state. And people, especially amateurs, but a lot of professionals as well, believe it or not, get those two mixed up. They believe that nationalism extols the state. Yeah, the problem is that the old German word for state doesn't just refer to the bureaucracy. The old German word for the way that Hegel used the term state refers to the constitution, the entire body of a people. The word constitution, none of these words have been totally denuded of meaning. Constitution is the language. It's the, what Losef would call a myth. It's the backdrop to all of our interactions. It's who we are. It's the nation. This is what the state was to Hegel. But believe it or not, it's pretty rare to find a commentator talking about him correctly. The German concept of state was far more broad than our concept. But when you're debating, you know, especially Orthodox people who are, you know, quite insecure in their, you know, this is such a minority religion. We're in such a debased environment. You know, half the time people don't understand, you know, what you're saying anyway. You know, you're speaking a foreign language to them. Sometimes I'm shocked by what the average person believes. I'm at a state now that, you know, there's almost no communication. But Chalcedon is all about communication, just like nations are. The nation is the body of the people. Now, there is no such entity as the people. The concept of we the people came from the first English Puritan Revolution, 1688 onwards. It was a myth, in the bad sense of the word. Parliament created the people as a way to challenge the role of the monarch. The people is an abstraction that has absolutely no meaning. At the time, Parliament represented the commercial elite. This increasingly deracinated group of people. It's kind of like what the Soviet Union referred to as proletarians. Well, Jacob Schiff was a proletarian in Trotsky's mind. But of course, the priest, the impoverished priest in Ukraine was a member of the ruling class, was a capitalist. So there's a reason why these things have absolutely no meaning. But the nation is the cultural body of a people. It's language in the broadest sense. I've defined it many times in the past, and I'll do it here again, as an understanding of the structures of survival. A nation, a group of people, they live in a certain area, certain topography, certain weather, certain soil that they have, certain resources they have to work with, clearly affects who they are. But they begin to suffer. Sometimes bad weather, sometimes foreign occupation, warfare, sometimes for a long period of time. The reaction that people have to this is what builds up the body of the nation. I said this with the canons. The canons are the structures of survival. The church comes under attack. This is its literary exposition. It's the result. It then refines the foundations of the church. Structures of survival are what a people does when it comes under attack. People unify. People consolidate their forces when it's absolutely necessary. Solidarity is increased when you're all suffering. The problem with prosperity always is that people become, you know, they're able to, and this is such a key message of the Old Testament, prosperity is a problem because people can satisfy every whim. It becomes the idea that success means money. Success means power. And that's exactly what success is. And in its worst sense, like we have now, that money somehow automatically confers wisdom. And, you know, they're almost divinities. Now, most of you have probably heard the notion that comes from early Byzantium, the epoch Noga. Temporal power, priesthood relate to each other as body and soul, necessary for a normal order, just as body and soul in a living man. End quote. It says, in this connection and harmony of a society lies. And in the seventh ecumenical synod, you hear the priest consecrates and strengthens the imperial power, and the imperial power through fair laws govern the earth. So there's conditions in both cases. Every once in a while, you hear a Protestant say that you can't oppose the state, and they quote that famous line in St. Paul about handling the sword for a good reason. This is pretty common. It's absurd. It's sort of like you're using him, there is no slave nor free, no man, no woman. Well, you see, that didn't negate the biology between, you know, men and women. That wasn't the point of it. That wasn't the point of that passage. These things are abused so badly. The famous formula in Paul refers to a godly state, a state that upholds natural law. Because if they don't, they're not a state. Because punishing evildoers, which that famous passage says, we already are assuming the concept of evil. Well, if they are, in fact, the evildoers, then it's another matter altogether. There can be no formula for revolution and things like this. Although you have it all over the place, including in the Old Testament itself. In the Old Testament, you see God raising up foreign pagan empires to punish Israel. Really, really, all Israel, you know, the Old Testament is just Israel completely refusing to live up to its obligations. I think the last time I mentioned Metropolitan Platon, and this is kind of the bad conception that he uses of the nation. This is what he says to Catherine the Second, the whore, as the Cossacks used to call her. He says the following: Church and society are connected in such a way that one is different from the other only in attitude. Civil society is union of people united by law in the same form of government, but that this same society is also united by the collective observance of one form of worship and the same sacred rites, the church. Now that's very, very formal. Metropolitan Platon, who was a good man, had to make his personal adjustments to the synodal system. Very unnatural, and the pagan foundation, literally the pagan foundation of Petrograd. By pagan here, I mean Gnostic. He uses this very formal language. But united by laws refers to, you know, assumes the idea that what we live under are actually laws, not just the arbitrary whims of a ruling class. The rites that he refers to are sacred, not just any old rite. All of this assumes qualitatively, not merely that someone rules, but that they rule well. A people united only by the laws can be any random group of people under any old set of laws or whims. Remember, the 18th century in Russia saw the church being reduced almost by half. There were Orthodox refugees all over Eastern Europe. In Manyava, in Austria, or the Austrian Empire, was founded by refugees from the Russian Empire. Because, you know, more than half the monasteries were closed by the middle of the century. There is a small army of new martyrs to the Petrine yoke, as I call it. And so, yeah, I include Catherine in that because it's the new ruling class was formed. This is one of the reasons why Platon has to use this formal language, because that's all they understood. The more formal the language is, the more quantitative it is, the more vapid it is. This isn't the nation, and it's not the church either. A law is only a law when it conforms with natural law, that is the very constitution of human beings, and there's an agreed upon body that can enforce it. It's something that's born with us. It's something that's inherent to creation. The human mind is not separate from the rest of creation, as the Enlightenment always assumed. Gradovsky writes this, the academic A.D. Gradovsky, 1875. He says the following: "The rights of the autocratic power relate only to church administration, not the content of the positive side of religion, like doctrine. This is the same for the Orthodox Church and other faiths in Russia. Competence of the supreme legal authority is limited to those cases that affect the external side of church administration, that is, that they do not involve acts that define the heart of the universal church, like the dogmatic decrees of the ecumenical synods." Now, Professor Suvorov, N.S. Suvorov in 1907, says this, which is a tad different. "The highest authority in the Russian Orthodox Church belongs to the autocratic monarchy. This principle is clearly expressed in the fundamental law of the Russian Empire, that's the Petrine Law. But this has been also a tradition inherited from the Greeks. The supreme autocratic power of the Russian emperor contains both state and church authority. The latter is carried out through the synod that justifies the emperor as head of state, has authority over the church located within the national territory. He personally must belong to the Orthodox Church, and as Christian monarch, he is supreme defender and custodian of the tenets of the faith, the guardian of orthodoxy." Well, under the circumstances, I guess this wasn't written with any sense of irony. In no way can Peter's Synod be considered a canonical body, in the sense that it is part of God's plan for us. It has no relation to the older conception of a synod, which would be the word sobor, is the same thing. That's not the same thing as council. Sobor is simply to be of one mind, to be morally unified. Initially, Peter wanted to call the synod the college, to differentiate it from the actual canonical sobor. But they were worried about the popular rejection of this, so they called it a synod for the sake of deception. But he is confronted by E. Temnikov 1 year later, 1909, and also by Firsov more recently. And he says this: "The contradiction between the religious and the political ideals can be considered not only derivative of the abnormal church-state relations that existed in Russia, but also from the personal drama of the last monarch. Legends of this last emperor, Nikolai II, served as compensation for this, especially given his mystical moods, which created, which remains interesting from the psychological point of view. It also serves as an answer to the question as to why Nikolai did not call a local council the church. Creating an image of the Holy King is complemented by some non-confirmed rumors that Nicholas II wanted to resolve the issue of the church by taking on the burden of the patriarchal service." End quote. But of course, we don't need rumors to demonstrate the fact that Nicholas was a holy man and a saint. The concept of Suvorov in 1907 is an outrage. But that is, and that was, the fundamental law of the empire at the time. The great Seraphim Sobolev, he argues forcibly that the Byzantine emperors were not involved in any dogmatic disputes at the conciliar level. Of course not. St. Constantine's example became the norm. He was not involved in the dogmatic disputes. He had no power over them because these men had had barely escaped death themselves. They weren't frightened. But Peter I was an open Satanist. And the whore Catherine I broke the Romanov line, because even according to the way that Suvorov mentions it, he was an Orthodox monarch. First of all, he was a Freemason. No one denies that. And second of all, his unholy drunken synod. People don't realize just how powerful this was. The unholy drunken synod, they had an entire hierarchy. They had hymns, books and books that were written. They had all these, you know, it was a complicated thing. It was a new ruling class. It was a consecration of demons. They would deliberately get drunk and outrage the churches of the area. And outrage the Greek. They rape people. You know, this is what, you know, Peter was a demonist. Alcohol was a method used to control people at the time. Also was a method of execution, by the way. Now, the church, since the fall of the monarchy in Russia, we all know that since the fall of the monarchy, it is incapable of self-government. Nothing could be more blatantly true than that. It's remarkable that the crown, regardless of its errors and other matters, has not attempted to attack doctrine directly. Only liberalism can do that. But once the doctrine was settled many centuries earlier, there was no attempt to alter it. Now that the ecumenical movement and everything else, they are trying to alter doctrine. There's also a strong move that I've mentioned before to deny the Old Testament. I want to make a prediction here. I want you guys to listen. The Old Testament is, to say the least, a national socialist conception. You have a deeply national idea in Israel, and you have a strong idealist socialism. I don't mean Marxism, obviously. That's blatantly clear, and especially in the prophets. If you haven't done it already, please read all the prophets. Christ doesn't make any sense without the prophets. I think, really, doctrine was altered, but only not through an open denial in a council, but simply by the decay of society. The 18th century was one of the darkest periods of time in Russian history prior to the Red Revolution. Archbishop Ambrose of Petrograd writes this on the Petrine Synod in the Petrine era. Quote, these men, now these are the people who came after Peter, Byron, Osterman, all Freemasons who came and ruled and under the you know ridiculous queens, the two Annas. Not to Elizabeth, though. Elizabeth got rid of them. But prior to her, anyway, he says, these men, Byron, Osterman, etc., they're enemies, obscene and destructive of the church. They see it as superstition to eradicate. By the way, Catherine also said that, and Peter said that. Many of the clergy have been destroyed, monks tortured and tormented. They will use any pretext to destroy the priesthood. Any pretext that will do so is to beat, ruin, eradicate, and annihilate the church from these godless robbers of the state treasury. After Peter's death, a group of Freemasons ran the country. And the monarchs, of course, all female, first Catherine I, who usually didn't know where she was most of the time, certainly was not Orthodox, she couldn't be Orthodox anyway. She simply was an alcoholic. She died of liver disease and compounded by sexually transmitted disease. And then two Annas after her. This period of time, fairly long period of time, was a foreign oligarchy ran the country. And this is a direct result of Peter's policy. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of saints and authors in the 19th century, for example, that won't condemn the synod. So, when we talk about the state, you know, the whole point of all of this is to explain the concept of state and church. Has to be very, very careful. We have to be very careful when we're talking about them. We use these words only as abbreviations. Now, I don't even think talking to the average person can even be an issue here. We're at a point where words mean different things. Then there can't be any discussion. This is the result of nominalism, industrialization. This is what happens to the psyche. And one of the expressions of that, maybe the consequence of that, is that words really become just playthings of the elite. Nominalism actually assumes that. Now, in Zimin's work, his article, Symphony of Power, he suggests that there are four ingredients to a healthy state of harmony. The first is that the ruling body has to be legitimate. So if it's an aristocratic kind of constitution, the symphony is broken when it becomes oligarchy. It's not the crown, therefore, but rather the state as a constitution that's working with the jury. Second, there has to be a great degree of civic participation and competence, meaning people have to know things. Third, the church, most of all, has to remain faithful to doctrine, but also behavior. I firmly believe that the Donatist idea is abused beyond belief. It's absolutely abused beyond belief. It seems to be a smokescreen that people can use, that bishops can use to justify rotten behavior. Anyway, his view is that social evil comes from human beings that overstress one area at the expense of another. It's an imperialist mentality that seeks to control everything. Eggsman's notions fit in line with St. Paul's conception of the state in Romans. It has to be legitimate. It has to have a foundation in natural law. Whether the positivist mentality that rules all of us today, it's anyone who is able to gather enough power to dominate everybody else. That's really all it comes down to. Now, he's not assuming that monarchy is the best form of government. But like Plato, he refers to the three good ones: monarchy, aristocracy, or democracy. The bad ones being tyranny, oligarchy, and mob rule. And of course, the citizen body has to be competent in public affairs. But the church also has a role. Now he's referring to us as individuals. There has to be a connection between doctrine and behavior. Using Donatism all the time that you protect these people is a terrible idea. The emperors Basil, Leo, and Alexander, Byzantine Empire, this is how they define the sovereign power. They describe it as legitimate over the common good. They say this: the state and its activities should be guided by the Holy Scriptures, the definition of the synods, and Roman law. The emperor must be firm in orthodoxy, and religious zeal must exceed all, including the priests. The explanation of the law needs to coincide with that of the customs, must be contrary to the canons. That's an extremely powerful, one of the best expressions of the Byzantine understanding of politics that I've ever read. The crown, and even the bureaucracy, has to be guided by the church. In other words, the actions of God, the grace on earth, the scriptures being one part, the canon being another part, but also the law, Roman law. This is natural law as it's developed over time. Nothing specifically Roman about it. It's just, this is what natural law is. This is where Cicero defined it. But to be legitimate, he has to be firm in orthodoxy too, and he has to be, because rule really is more example than anything else. These are icons of ethics, not ruling in the sense of executing people. Remember, this is an era where you didn't have this pagan pantheon of celebrities and media, which control everything. You know, the celebrity, the emperor was one of them. His religious zeal must exceed everyone, including the priests. And he also assumes the law is being explained to people. When Ezra reconstituted Israel with a handful of people, he realized that people he came with had no idea, had never seen the law, had never read it. It had just been uncovered anyway. I mean, they had completely fallen away. They didn't know anything. You know, we're in that position right now. But the quote I just read, the emperor is a sort of bishop who rules by example rather than coercion. Custom is just an expression of natural law when based on a specific people and therefore the same essence. Bishop of Dalmatia, Nicodem, in 1897. His conception of politics in symphony, that the powers of the king, God's people, he said they differ substantially from the authority of kings of others. The Orthodox rule is different. It's the king that builds the symphonic relationship between the priesthood of his kingdom and God's kingdom. I'm not quoting him now, I'm just simply explaining it. The emperor, and he refers to him as head of state, he is the patron and protector of the church in public and civil law, but he's also a member of the church. He's subject to its laws on par with his subjects. This is why the 18th century emperors in Russia were not legitimate. They didn't believe in orthodoxy. And by the way, Elizabeth is an exception to that. Thank God for her. He punishes heretics and schismatics. So to be a legitimate state, according to Bishop Nicodem, to be legitimate, he has to not only recognize heresy, but punish it. And he has to punish them as state criminals. In matters of church government, the emperor has a right to convene synods and the right to approve higher clergy. The synod chooses three candidates, and he picks one. He has a right to monitor the progress of church affairs, and especially the behavior. The dogma has been settled. That's not the issue. Behavior of the clergy, and then, of course, the right of legislation for the church in spirit and basis of the canons. And what he means by that simply is that he can't create dogma, but he does have the right to legislate to enforce it, which is a whole separate body of law. That means no heterodox ruler can be legitimate in Russia. So that eliminates everyone but Elizabeth in the 18th century. The Tsar is primarily a religious figure. You know, terms like Cicero, papism are meaningless. It shows you that people don't understand anything. That's not the issue. We're not talking about ruling and dominating. You're going to go to jail if you do the wrong thing. This is not what we're talking about. Remember, we live in a society completely saturated by media and propaganda. This is a society that was not. And it's often so difficult to put ourselves in their position. I'll end with Lev Tikhomirov, former revolutionary, became a monarchist. I'll quote him here from 1905. The importance of the Russian Tsar is found in its position relative to the worldly problems of Christianity. All authority is from God, our church teaches, but the Russian Tsar has particular importance, distinguishing it from all other rulers in the world. He's not only the emperor of the country and the leader of the nation, he's also the guardian and protector of the church. The church doesn't know of any earthly vicar and has renounced any action save the spiritual realm. The Tsar is in charge of the church's earthly well-being and is consecrated by the church as leader of the Orthodox people. The Tsar is far more than just the heir of his ancestors. He's also the successors. The Caesars in Rome, of Byzantium, were organizers of the church synods that established the very symbol of the Christian faith. The fall of Byzantium, Moscow rose. From this comes Russian greatness, end quote. So where are we now? This is the nature of the struggle. The symphony of powers requires a unity of religious and moral principles and a single consensus. This comes from St. Photius. The fundamental agreement is absolutely essential for even those rudimentary consensus to emerge. State must itself be united, a united force around a monarchy and a chosen council, Senate. Unity comes first. The spiritual power must also be unified itself. It's an ascetic authority, never a coercive power. Metropolitan Ion of Petersburg in the 80s. He describes a bit later than that. He describes symphony as a form of joint action in the service of a common good. Scriptures lay this out. It's a pledge for social order and equity. Each half of this unity must be integral and unified. There is a single divine source, but two separate and independent fields. God essentially wants to entrust the preservation of truth in specific kingdoms chosen by him. In the Old Testament, this was entrusted to Israel. In the New Testament, it's consistently entrusted to really three kingdoms. Rome is the capital of the world, world in the old sense of the term. They fell into heresy, and this is really essentially Metropolitan John's concept. Latins were removed from office, then it was given to Constantinople. And he says it was removed due to selfish political calculations to destroy the purity of the faith, because of the Unia. Lateran ministry was removed, and then Russia. For the mission to be accepted, John says, a new organization of the church deciding the state is required. This godly organization is the autocracy. The czar is God's anointed. He is not limited in his autocratic prerogative, except the nature of the service itself. The gospel is the constitution of the autocracy. The Orthodox czar is a personification of God's chosen people and their God-bearing mission. He's a guardian of the third realm. Where are we now?
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.